Today we are going to plan, we'll finish up Acts chapter 4, what we had finished up with the account, and actually, in my opinion, they should have ended Acts chapter 4 at verse 31, where we ended last week, and this verse 32 of Acts 4 should actually be the first verse of Acts chapter 5, because this is a whole new thought, and it is cohesive with the thought and the account of Ananias and Sapphira, how chapter 5 opens up. But how we have finished in what previously, and what the main account of Acts chapter 4 was over, was that Peter and John healed a man going into the temple, and that had been crippled and unable to walk since birth. And so for the first time in his life, he was able to walk. And that got everyone's attention. And it especially got the attention of, namely, the Sadducees. And because then, after Peter and John performed this miracle, then they started telling everyone, all of the Jews there in the temple, about the Messiah, and that they had killed him, and that Jesus was the Messiah. And they all remembered about that they had crucified these three men, and that one at least claimed to be the Messiah. And they're saying, and then Peter and John start telling all of the people, well, he's the one that has given us this power to heal this man. And you killed him, but he resurrected. He did not stay in the grave, and he's not in the grave now. And that is what got the ire up of the Sadducees, who deny that there's anything such as a spirit, and so there could not be a resurrection from the dead. And so they brought Peter and John before the Sanhedrin, which was the council, it was like the Supreme Court for the Jews. And this was the providence of God, because without this incident and without the evilness that the Sadducees intended, which was to have Peter and John killed, it actually allowed Peter to speak before the Sanhedrin and let them know about the Messiah and his kingdom. And so this was his plan. And then Kaufman's comment was, you know, without these bad intentions of the Sadducees, then Peter and John and the apostles would never have had the opportunity to have even spoken, in the Sanhedrin wouldn't have had the opportunity to have spoken to them, and they never would have heard the words about God's kingdom. And so this was the opportunity. That way the Sanhedrin now had no excuse on being disobedient. Okay, so will any questions or comments on anything here? We will now start with verse 32, which is a completely new thought of what had transpired of Acts chapter 3 and 4. But verse 32 of Acts 4, "Now the multitude of those who believed were of one heart and one soul. Neither did anyone say that any of the things he possessed was his own, but they had all things in common." And Kaufman said, "This is a reference to the event that was originally documented in Acts chapter 2. Luke repeated this as an introduction to the account regarding Ananias and Sapphira. The custom of having all things common, which began shortly after Pentecost, had continued until the time of these events. But Luke's reference to it here sheds new light upon it." And the phrase, "the things which he possessed," Kaufman said, "it is clear that private property had not been abolished. It is taught here What is taught here is not that the institution of private possessions had been abolished, but that the Christians held their possessions not as their own, but as subject to the will of God in the use of them for the relief of the needy Christians. This was an emergency, and all were willing and anxious to use whatever they possessed for the common good. In the fact of the emergency, there is a clue suggesting that all of the events mentioned this far in Acts occurred within a very short space of time after Pentecost. My thought, very likely, this is just the next week or 2 weeks after Pentecost. It's just very shortly afterward that these events took place. Because the most logical reason for any emergency, which is actually inferred rather than plainly stated, lies in the fact that vast throngs in Jerusalem for Pentecost, after obeying the gospel, continued to remain in Jerusalem for a time to hear the preaching of the apostles and perhaps to aid in evangelism. Naturally, such an institution would terminate after a while, and the extreme generosity of the local Christians that lived in Jerusalem prolonged it as long as possible. So the thought being here that the new Christians, those that were baptized on Pentecost and thereafter, but namely starting there at Pentecost, they had planned to just come for the day of Pentecost and maybe a few days later and then go home as they had done every year. And so they just had provisions basically for a week trip. I don't know, maybe 2 weeks, but probably just a week. And as a result, this was they wanted to stay and hear the good news about God's kingdom that the apostles were teaching. And so they had run out of the provisions that they had planned on. And so the Christians that lived here, the Jewish Christians, they're all Jewish, of course, here at this time, that lived in Jerusalem, they would sell some of their possessions and provide in order so these people don't have to go back home. Which we know from Acts chapter 2, they came from every region all over the Roman Empire. So they're coming from way off, hundreds of miles away. And so this was very necessary and for the young congregation and kingdom to be able to grow for this very critical time at the beginning. Any questions or comments on anything here?
That's quite a thing for them to sell their possessions to help the others.
Yes.
You know, because I don't think the Jews would do that to Jews.
Well,
they were pretty selfish.
There's no example of that. And even today, not necessarily much of an example. So, yes. Yes, it's mentioned here as something, I'll say, peculiar, definitely out of the norm. And Kaufman's going to say, he's going to call this an experiment, is what he's going to call it here a little later. But he said this is something that at least that they tried here at the beginning for this purpose, and then it was dropped and never repeated again. And right, this was for a specific emergency because these people had traveled long ways. They were going to have to go home or they were going to go hungry. But if you could house them and feed them, they would stay here and they would then you would be able to the apostles would be able to teach them the good news of God's kingdom. And we don't know how long they stayed. Now, Kaufman's thought is that they stayed a shorter amount of time. My thought is that they stayed until Acts 8. And that's when Paul's persecution, his name was Saul at that time, got so severe, he started killing and imprisoning these Christians. And at that point, every Christian fled Jerusalem except for the 12 apostles. They were the only Christians left in all of Jerusalem. All the others fled. My thought is that most of these, or at least a lot of these Christians that were from afar off, they stayed there until Acts 8. That's when they went home. But now they've been educated and taught, and they're well versed about God's kingdom. And so everywhere they went, they taught, and I'm assuming went back home. And now they were teaching and spreading the good news of God's kingdom. And so this was all in God's plan. So what Paul thought he was snuffing out this young Christian religion, and instead he helped to spread it. So again, what he thought he was damaging, God used it for good. So, verse 33. And with great power the apostles gave witness to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and great grace was upon them all. This in particular is what the Sadducees had against these apostles. And this is what they want them killed over, because they are teaching and that they are witnesses of his resurrection, which they all were. They witnessed and saw Jesus alive out of the grave for 40 days after the resurrection. And so, and verse 34, nor was there anyone among them who lacked, for all who were possessors of land or houses sold them and brought the proceeds of the things that were sold and laid them at the apostles' feet, and they distributed to each as everyone had need. So, it was giving to these that were generous and had plenty, and giving to these which obviously were out of town and they were needy at this time. And this was housing and feeding them so they could be taught. Otherwise, they were going to have to leave. That was the consequence of not providing for these young Christians.
That would have been a lot of money for selling a piece of land.
Yes.
House.
Yes.
So that was quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. This is, I think we would, this is pretty drastic. But this is drastic circumstances. You know, God's kingdom was just established. This is the thing that many of these, several of these, and the whole Jewish nation, whether they realized it or not, they had been waiting on this time for the Messiah to come and establish his kingdom. They've been waiting on this for centuries and millennia. And so this was the very, very important time. It is understandable that people would go to somewhat of an extreme extent and decrease their financial wealth in order for this occasion. And it was very valuable to that, because this laid the foundation for spreading the gospel, at least in Acts 8, if not even before then. Kaufman said about these three verses and the phrase, "Great grace was upon them all," the result of such overflowing generosity was that the effectiveness of the apostles' message was multiplied. And what might be called a revival of the most fantastic proportions followed. In the phrase, possessors of land or houses, Kaufman said, "We are authorized by the literal meaning of the text to assume that all the owners of real estate who were Christians sold property, but not that they sold all the real estate that they owned. Each one contributed a certain portion, but it is not said here that each one disposed of his whole property. We are not even definitely told that a single individual handed over all that he owned." And the phrase, "to each as anyone had need," This shows that only the needy received anything, and that those who were not needy were the givers. These members of God's kingdom were not a commune or a socialist club, as many have falsely believed and taught. There is no uniform distribution of the property among all the members, nor was the property held and administered by the apostles. It was not a matter of providing for every member, but of supplying the needs of those who lacked. It is true that the plan of having all things common was not continued for very long. Perhaps in the event about to be related about Ananias and Sapphira, Luke intended that we should behold the failure of the experiment. This plan was never tried elsewhere. So Kaufman is under the belief that this experiment somewhat failed. I don't see it that way. I see it that it was successful, highly successful. It kept the Christians there for the time that was needed to hear the apostles' teaching. And then, when the time was right and they were educated enough to go and spread the gospel, then they did at that time. And then there was no need for this such of a drastic distribution of wealth any longer. And Kaufman finishes up with the paragraph on this passage. No universal selling of property is mentioned, and no general instructions were issued that members of God's kingdom should distribute to the poor all that they possessed. Many of the owners of property of their own free will, from the love of the brethren, and at this specific time, sold their property and brought the proceeds to the apostles. So this was just for this specific need at this specific time, which was the very beginning of God's kingdom, which would be the most important time for anything to get off the ground. It's the hardest at the very beginning. And then after it has grown some, then it can kind of grow, not necessarily on its own, but it's a lot easier to get it to grow, just like a plant. Whenever you have the seed, that's its most critical time that you have to give it the most care and most attention. After it starts to get a root system and it's grown some, well, it can basically sustain itself with much less care and maintenance.
Well, Lance, wasn't it Paul that said, you know, take up contribution or whatever?
Yes.
So that we won't have to gather when we get there.
Yes, and that is the next specific need. And now, whereas here, these are the local Christians that live locally in Jerusalem that are selling their land and property and possessions and giving food and housing to these others that are staying, then it's reversed. Now, some years later go down and there's a famine. And this is 1 Corinthians 16. Now there's a famine in Jerusalem. And it's the poor Christians, the poor saints in Jerusalem that are the needy ones. So now Paul is going on his third missionary journey, and he's going over the areas of the Roman Empire, and he tells the Christians, and then it's recorded in Corinth, but I'm assuming he told the others and other places he went. But anyway, we get it in Corinthians, so it's the people in Corinth, and he tells them, ahead of time, he sends out a letter. I'm coming. Start saving up. And so whenever you have the money and you store, the text says, everyone store by himself. So you save up your funds, and that way you don't have to do any savings. Whenever I get there, you'll have it, and you'll give it to me, and I'll take it to the poor saints in Jerusalem. So that's another specific time for a specific need, just as this is. Example.
Did you want to go ahead and read those two?
1 Corinthians 16? Okay. It's the first 1 Corinthians 16, verses 1 and 2. Okay. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 1, "Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given orders to the churches in Galatia, So you must also do. On the first day of the week, let each one of you lay aside something aside and store up. And the Greek text says, store up by him as he may prosper, that there be no collections when I come. And then when I come, whomever you approve by your letters, I will send to bear your gift to Jerusalem. This was specifically for the poor saints in Jerusalem. And there was no collection beforehand. And then, guess what? The question is, did they keep saving up money and storing up money after he came? Obviously, no. He wasn't coming back again. So this was just for this specific time. They saved up until he came. They gave him the funds. Paul left. They didn't save any more for this occasion. And so this was just as this was for a specific time and a specific purpose.
So they were not taking contribution every week?
No, they were not doing any contribution before this. Paul commanded them to do this until he came. And then they handed over the funds. And then there was no reason for them to keep collecting. Definitely for the poor saints in Jerusalem, because they were already, Paul was going to take care of them with these funds. And he never did come around again. So it was just, for a short time, for a specific purpose. Back in Acts chapter 4, verses 36 and 37. And Joseph, who was also named Barnabas by the apostles, which is translated son of encouragement, a Levite of the country of Cyprus, having land, sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. This is the first mention of Barnabas. And then it gives what his name means, son of encouragement. And now he's a very well known. He goes with Paul on his first missionary journey. And his nephew is John Mark, who is the one thought to have written the book of Mark. And also, John Mark is thought to be the young boy that Mark mentions. He doesn't say that it was himself, but he mentions there was a young boy that followed behind Jesus and the apostles as they were leaving the Last Supper and going to the Garden of Gethsemane, and then he witnessed the soldiers and the elders come to arrest Jesus, and they grabbed hold of this young boy, and he was wrapped in a sheet, and he just let go of that sheet and ran off into the darkness because this was midnight. And it is thought that Mark was telling about himself when he was a young adolescent. And anyway, this is who this is. This is the family. And it's also Barnabas's sister has a large house. And the Kaufman's going to mention that here. And in fact, it's right here in this here that, and she's able to hold a prayer meeting and have quite a few people come in. So she still owns this big, large house later on. And where Peter comes to after the angel releases him from prison, and that's when Rhoda failed to open the door for him. And that's at Barnabas's sister's house, who is John Mark's mother. And so this is the example that Kaufman is giving, that they didn't sell all of their property. She still owns this big house even afterward. Years later, or whatever the time frame is down the line. But Kaufman said here about these two verses, it should be noted that not a word is given here to the effect that Barnabas sold all that he had. Then there is further consideration that the sister of Barnabas, Mary, the mother of John Mark, appears in Acts 12 as the owner of a large residence in Jerusalem, capable of housing a considerable portion of the Christians for a prayer meeting, the house having a courtyard and a gate, which was attended by the serving girl, Rhoda. It was not the practice of those early disciples to make a total liquidation of their assets in order to distribute all to the poor. And about Barnabas, Barnabas was the faithful and distinguished Christian who accompanied Paul on the first missionary journey. Having related the example of the generosity of Barnabas, Luke would at once relate the story of Ananias and Sapphira and their ill-conceived scheme. This incident, about to be narrated in Acts chapter 5, has the value of shedding even more light on the false claim of communism of Acts. Any questions or comments on anything here?